For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. So, good morning. I'm Aishan, Nancy Easton, and I'm going to talk a little bit about, well, I'm going to talk and read from a work by Ehe Dogen called Instructions to the Tenzo, or Tenzo Kyokun, which is part of the Ehe Shingi, which I believe this text Dogen wrote for, it's kind of practical instructions for living within a monastery. And I believe he wrote it around 1237, so probably about a little more than two-thirds into his life. He was one of our most esteemed founders of our school of Zen, and he lived from about 1500 to 1553, and 1200. Sorry, 1200. Thank you. So yeah, so he wrote this in 1237. Thank you very much. And I thought that this would be I have actually been Tenzo here for just about a year and have learned many things and was sort of rereading this text and thought that it would be maybe interesting to talk about reflections on being the Tenzo and reading a little bit together. Although the Tenzo is, you know, sort of one of six administrative positions in a monastery, as being the chief cook and preparer of meals for the assembly, even in our small little storefront temple in Chicago, we have these same six positions. And the other positions that are traditional within a Zen monastery would be the Ino, which in this case is currently occupied by Laurel, the director, who is Douglas. We have an assistant director, Ben, who is not here today, our work leader, Jeremy, and we have a treasurer, Dave, who is also not here. And in our modern times, because we function in, you know, sort of the West as part of a traditional nonprofit Western sangha, our treasurer is one of the positions of the board of directors, which is a little bit separate, but it's still a training position. And so these are positions in which that are held by people traditionally and have traditional roles and responsibilities, but they're more than just a job. It's an opportunity for people to wake up in the things that they are doing as part of these positions. So in the Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen talks about cooking as practice, but even though that, I guess what I was going to say before is, even though this pertains to sort of monastic life, I think this pertains to everybody's everyday life, not just in cooking, but also in how we relate to the practical things around us. Cooking is maybe one of the most practical things that we all have to do every day, but there's plenty of others, you know, cleaning your house, putting on clothes, dealing with coworkers, riding the bus, and I think that that's maybe why this text in particular has become very popular in modern life, as people think about, you know, how am I relating to the world around me? And so, you know, what we can think of Dogen as saying is, you know, how do you take care of oneself and others and what one is doing as a form of practice? I won't speak for you all, habitual maybe tendency to or approach to life is, you know, kind of taking an attitude that, you know, I can enjoy myself when I have finished taking care of external matters and I don't have to relate to anything and I can just sort of, you know, flake out and so there are lots of little things that we or I maybe don't pay so much attention to in daily life, you know, one of which would be maybe washing the dishes or things that you feel like you just have to sort of get through in order to get onto the real matter or the real, you know, stuff of life. But in this text, Dogen instructs us that realization, awakening, patience, generosity, and well-being are really found in relating to life as it is. You know, we can't control what comes to us, so we try to work with whatever comes. There's nothing that is beneath our attention in the world. So I thought I'd start by reading the first couple paragraphs of this text. And he starts off by saying, Zen monasteries have traditionally had six officers who are all Buddha's disciples and all share Buddha activities. Among them, the Tenzo is responsible for preparing meals for the monks. Regulations for Zen monasteries states, in order to make reverential offerings to monks, there is a position called Tenzo. Since ancient times, this position has been held by accomplished monks who have way-seeking mind, or by senior disciples with an aspiration for enlightenment. This is so because the position requires wholehearted practice. Those without way-seeking mind will not have good results in spite of their efforts. Regulations for Zen monasteries states, use your way-seeking mind carefully to vary the menus from time to time and offer the great assembly ease and comfort. Long ago, Guishan Lingyu, Dongshan Shochu, and other great teachers held this position. A Tenzo is not the same as an ordinary cook or waiter. And so I think what he means when he says a Tenzo is not the same as an ordinary cook or waiter is that he's focusing on and he's about to expand upon the quality of needing to possess and maintain and cultivate way-seeking mind. You know, it's not people just fulfilling their jobs, but looking for meaning. And one of Dogen's kind of major teachings is that we can't separate meaning from everyday activity, that nirvana and samsara are one big pot. That's something that comes out of the middle way. So way-seeking mind, I think... I know for sure that you all have a glimpse of it or you wouldn't be here, actually. We sometimes refer to it as bodhicitta, and it starts whenever we have some glimpse that we can recognize innate dignity, wisdom, compassion, patience, and humor within ourselves, regardless of external conditions. So even though you may not consciously recognize that quality is what brought you here today, I know for sure that it is present, and that what we do when we come for Zazen is we just, you know, sit down and let that kind of, you know, percolate or cultivate a little bit so that when we get up off of our cushions, each action that we take, you know, begins to more and more reflect the way and reflect the Dharma of thusness, which is things just being as they is. Or it's also known in Japanese as Nyoho, the Dharma of thusness. And so when our life and our activities reflect the Dharma of thusness, they offer what Yunmen referred to as an appropriate response. There was a question of, you know, what is it that we're trying to do here? And what is it that we're trying to do with Zazen? And Yunmen's answer was, you know, an appropriate response. We respond to things in an appropriate way so that all aspects of our life in a Zen center or in a monastery are something that reflects an appropriate response or the Dharma of thusness or Nyoho. We have, you know, a Zendo, for instance, that is comfortable and it supports us to sit comfortably. We have, you know, it's clean. It's heated enough, but not so hot that we're, you know, baking or falling asleep. It's just enough. You know, it's not super ornate or super elaborate, but it's adequate to our needs. So with respect to food that adheres to this quality of the Dharma of thusness would be simple, nourishing, tasty, maybe in season, something that ideally is tasty, but it doesn't arouse either craving or aversion. That's we try to have things that work in such a way that we're not overly like, oh, how can I get myself more of that? Or, you know, oh, please, no, I don't think I can deal with this. also, as I'll talk about in a little bit, food that meets this Nyoho quality offers us in each meal the six tastes and three virtues. And I'll get into what that is in a little bit. But similarly, even if you're not the Tenzo and you're not sort of selecting and preparing food, even the way that we eat in the Zendo is using, it's in accord with the Dharma of thusness. We use Oryoki bowls, or we eat in the Oryoki style, and Oryoki actually means just enough. We put out three bowls and we take just enough food to, you know, satisfy our hunger. We eat everything that we take. We eat according to a particular ritual that people learn during sessions and then practice and then, you know, maybe disagree over the particulars of endlessly. But we wash our own bowls. We pack our sets back up. We, you know, keep everything neat and tidy. We avoid wasting food. All of this is a way to try to harmonize ourselves with reality. And because we are not separate from the world, just having this ordinary give and take with the, you know, objects and experiences and people around us can help us wake up and to express our awakening. So there's way-seeking mind in all of these different activities. And in preparing food and using the objects of the kitchen, we can, with awareness, really start to realize our interdependence with all things. You know, even though we don't serve food or animal products, with the exception of some dairy products, we recognize that, you know, even these carrots have given their lives so that we are eating them, and we are depending on food and farmers and people who bring the food to us. We're depending on each other to help prepare. We're depending on others to help serve. And so we get more of a practical observation because we're paying attention of our independence. So historically, there have been some basic, you know, practical sort of how-to instructions, and I'll read you a few of them and then talk about these a little bit. The first one is, when you wash rice and prepare vegetables, you must do it with your own hands and with your own eyes, making sincere effort. Do not be idle, even for a moment. Do not be careful about one thing and careless about another. Do not give away your opportunity, even if it is merely a drop in the ocean of merit. Do not fail to place even a single particle of earth at the summit of the mountain of wholesome deeds. So do not give away your opportunity to meet this, whatever it is that you're doing, with your full attention. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I believe the second one. After you cook the vegetables for the morning meal, before preparing the rice and soup for the noon meal, assemble the rice buckets and other utensils and make sure they are thoroughly clean. Put what is suited to a high place in a high place, and what belongs in a low place in a low place. Those things that are in a high place will be settled there. Those that are suited to be in a low place will be settled there. Select chopsticks, spoons, and other utensils with equal care. Examine them with sincerity and handle them skillfully. And then finally, Dogen is talking about other sort of aspects of preparing and cooking the food, and then he says, when this is settled, calculate the quantities of food you will need. For those who need one full serving of rice, plan for that much. For those who need half, plan for that much. In the same manner, you can also plan for a serving of one-third, one-fourth, one-half, or two-halves. In this way, serving a half portion to each of two people is the same as serving one average person. Or if you plan to serve 9/10 of one portion, you should notice how much is not prepared. Or if you keep 9/10, how much is prepared. So he's talking about, the activities that people engaged in at that time around preparing food. I think for us, I think of it in things that we do in the kitchen, like, you know, measuring and working with precision. We plan meals to accommodate people's dietary restrictions. We plan to accommodate the number of guests. We try to reuse leftovers. And we try to work with such precision that we don't have waste, and we have enough, but not so much left over. I actually discovered something in being the Tenzo this year when we prepare meals, we typically do three different bowls of different things. The first one is a grain, the second one is usually some kind of protein or soup, the third one is usually a salad. And I got accustomed to having a fairly good knowledge of particular quantities for, you know, particular numbers of people. And then over the summer, it seemed that I was always running out of things. And what I discovered was I started using different bowls. And when we make up Oriyoki sets for people here in the Zendo, we had been using, you know, sort of a couple of lacquer bowls that stacked inside a ceramic bowl, and there were different sizes. They didn't always stack well. Sometimes things fell over. It got messy. And I had found that we had these wonderful, you know, big lacquer bowls. So we could use, you know, for most people, we could use the larger lacquer bowl and then these two little small lacquer bowls, but they just nestled in there so neatly. And it just seemed like so much more, you know, uniform, and everybody had the same looking set. Only what I discovered was that these large bowls they're gigantic. They're like way bigger than the ordinary ceramic bowls that we were using. And I think my hypothesis was that people were just, you know, asking for, you know, enough rice so that it looked appropriate to the size of the bowl, not so much paying attention to, you know, their own hunger, but just sort of the social cues that tell us like how much is a portion and how much do we eat. And sure enough, you know, when I decided for the most recent 3-day sashin in October, I was just going to go back to the small ceramic bowls. And yeah, and there's plenty of rice left, you know. So there are different, you know, things that we learn about interacting with food and with our environment. Other ways that we would maybe attend to the tasks with precision would be, you know, not wasting any materials or ingredients. So we try to take whatever food is left over from a previous meal when we're here for several days and turn it into leftovers. And I was surprised the second evening of sashin, I had been, you know, making two meals a day with different bowls, you know, three different bowls for each meal. And by Saturday night, I had, you know, quite an accumulation of sort of motley leftovers. And so, you know, what you kind of just, you know, throw them in together, try to find something that will be tasty. And what I came up with was something that involved vegetarian chili, brown rice with shiitake mushrooms, butternut squash, grape tomatoes, avocado salad dressing, buttermilk, shredded cheddar cheese, breadcrumbs, things that I was sort of, you know, looking at and just going, oh, I don't know. I hope this is okay.
We're good.
Thank you. And so, you know, then, you know, you slap on a name, cheesy squashy rice bake, and and there it is, you know, because I am a big recipe follower. I think one of the big learning things for me with being Tenzo is I am not a natural cook. I do not know how to combine ingredients. I've had some disasters, but cheesy squashy rice bake was a big hit. And I think it still fit within Nyoho in that it did. I don't think it inspired any craving. I don't think anybody, you know, was sort of like, I have to have more of this right now. But I don't think it inspired any aversion either. So it was, you know, so you have to find a middle ground. And we managed to not, you try to plan a series of meals so that you can combine things and not waste things. Another way of interacting with our materials would be, you know, not leaving things lying around for someone else to clean unless we're invited to. And specifically on Sundays, I invite you to, if you use a cup in the back, just throw it in the sink, because I will typically wash them all in the end. So you are all invited to just throw cups in the sink. And otherwise, in general, we tend to try to put things back in their place and put them where we found them or where we know they belong. And if we don't know where they belong, you know, asking other people. And so by doing these very routine things, whether we are doing them correctly or we are not doing them and maybe they're, you know, being brought to our attention, we can begin to see the effects of our actions on ourselves and on other people. And this is kind of how we wake up. I often hear people talk about when they've been practicing for a little while and they start to think about, you know, how can I bring this to other parts of my life? People will talk about how they never really noticed what washing dishes was like before. And washing dishes, I think, is a specific one because it is one of those things that we tend to just want to regard as like, let's just get through this and move on. And I've had, I know one person who discovered that they really enjoy washing dishes. They like interacting with the water and the suds and the materials. And so, it is possible to wake up in that kind of activity. I have discovered that as I have been practicing, my house has become much more sustainably clean. Not that that's like a good thing or a goal or anything like that, but I know for myself, and it's more just observing myself. I used to, when I was younger, you know, I'd come home and I didn't want to relate to anything. I just, you know, throw stuff over here, throw stuff over there, and then I would go, you know, a couple times a year on some sort of cleaning rampage where you just go through the whole house and it takes the whole weekend, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I discovered that over time, And observing sort of like, what is it that leads to that pile of mail or that pile of clothes? I would sort of observe, like, I'd come home and I'd be like, ah, I don't feel like dealing with this right now. And sometimes that's okay. And you get a pile for a little while and then, you know, you kind of reduce the pile. But it's something to observe, you know, about our lives and the ways in which that is maybe helpful or not helpful. So definitely a practical aspect that we can all relate to in our lives. And maybe fits in with what Dogen is saying in the first passage I read about, do not give away your opportunity. You know, if we approach each activity in the kitchen or out with way-seeking mind, then really each task that's presented to us is an opportunity to wake up and realize Buddha nature. Sometimes an opportunity to extend ourselves past our usual limits, to engage a little bit more with the world. It doesn't mean we don't sometimes need a break, too. I mentioned also the putting things that belong in a high place in a high place and putting things that belong in a low place in a low place. I don't think there is necessarily a predetermined place, you know, that things have to be. There's no set high or low place, but even in your own kitchen, you have a sense of where things fit so that they work better for the person who's usually using the kitchen. And so things have their appropriate place. In our kitchen, we try to just put them back where they were, our kitchen here. Similarly, you know, we don't treat everything the same. We don't handle a sharp knife or a heavy pot the way that you handle chopsticks. But you do handle, so you don't handle them the same, but you do handle them with equal care and attention. So the way that you would handle chopsticks is appropriate to chopsticks. And the way that you would handle a sharp knife is you know, very different, but appropriate to a sharp knife. And it's the same thing with ingredients. I think I missed something I really wanted to say. Okay, no, it's here. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay. So it is the same with ingredients, though. Some ingredients go well together, some ingredients don't go well together. cheesy squashy rice bakes seem to have ingredients that harmonized well. But I once, you know, in college tried to make hamburger noodle casserole with split pea soup instead of cream of mushroom soup. It didn't seem like a big deal to me. I just thought, you know, well, how bad could it be? Horrible. Horrible. I had roommates who never let me forget this, and sort of, I think I was, you know, left with this impression that I'm really a bad cook and I probably should just stay out of the kitchen. So this has been a very adventurous year for me. It's also the same, though, with people. You know, each person has their own strengths and weaknesses, and the trick in any part of our life is to try to help us harmonize together. So when you know something, when you know more about something than someone else, you try to help them to harmonize with the way that things are. And when you yourself don't really know, you try to, you know, figure out, okay, let's watch other people and see how I can harmonize with this situation. So that we kind of are just, you know, cooking everything together. We're cooking every moment. You know, we're each moment we're trying to meet the situation with an appropriate response. I also want to talk a little bit about the six tastes and three virtues. The three virtues are that food should demonstrate mildness, cleanliness or purity, and formality or dignity. So we don't, you know, mess stuff up. I perhaps came close to the edge of the window of that with cheesy squashy rice bake, but still trying to stay within, you know, reasonable dignity. The six tastes. Anybody know what the six tastes are? We kind of commonly have four tastes that we, you know that our tongue will measure, which would be bitter, sour, sweet, and salty. The other two tastes of the six would be hot and plain. And so during, if you are here for lunch during a sesshin, you will hear the Kokyo chant at one point, "The three virtues and six tastes of this meal are offered to Buddha and Sangha." And that's what those are, the three virtues, the six different tastes. When we plan a menu for a meal, you try to incorporate all of those elements. So the three virtues and six tastes of this meal are offered to Buddha and Sangha. May all sentient beings in the universe be equally nourished. That is sort of the chant right before we start eating. And all sentient beings being equally nourished, it doesn't mean that everybody eats the same amount or eats the same thing. It means that each is eating according to what is appropriate for them. Like with the large bowls, sometimes people will eat more. Also during sesshin, sometimes we don't have as many cues for hunger. The idea during a sesshin is that we come here and we eat what's prepared and we eat what's offered, and we generally, unless there are exceptions to this, don't bring things in from outside, and we don't go elsewhere. And so in a lot of cases, our hunger cues go away. We're not being constantly provoked with images or choices in particular. And I've discovered over a long sesshin, it helps things to settle down. I think that's one thing that we don't always get the opportunity to do as much here, because we're going home in between and we have, you know, Starbucks down the street where we, and there's nothing wrong with it. I do it as well. You know, we go sometimes, you know, after lunch and get a coffee or something like that. But it does, you know, any time that we, I don't know, the one of the great things about a sesshin is it imposes some discipline on us, and if we adhere to the discipline, we can observe our cravings and aversion and our particular reactions. And when we, in our ordinary lives, we don't have the opportunity to do that in quite the same way, and so it's harder to observe those things. I know when I was at Green Gulch Farm out in California as part of San Francisco Zen Center for a 21-day intensive, they would have rest days or break days periodically. And generally, we were eating really wonderful food that was being prepared by the Tenzo and their staff there. And it was great. It was just enough. It was, you know, very appropriate. And then on rest days, they would add in dessert after dinner. And it was like, it was like the greatest thing, but it's also like really kind of torture, because it was only like every 4 days. And so I would, you know, get through dinner, get this, you know, helping of dessert, and there's plenty of it, but, you know, everybody wants it. And, you know, you sit there and you eat your dessert and you're like, oh, how can I get some more of this? You know, and it's like suddenly, you know, after days of just being okay, suddenly you're like, oh, craving, what am I gonna do with this? And I commented on this to somebody who had been living there for quite some time, and you know, she just sort of laughed and said, yeah, you know, that doesn't really ever go away. You know, we're always interacting with our cravings and our, you know, our likes and our dislikes, or our cravings and aversions. They don't ever really go away, but we become more able maybe to, you know, find a way to kind of navigate through them, and maybe to help others around us navigate through their own. So, which brings me to talking a little bit about the attitude of the Tenzo, and I'm gonna do a little more reading from Dogen. Whoa. So, he says, when you prepare food, do not see with ordinary eyes and do not think with ordinary mind. Take up a blade of grass and construct a treasure king's land. Enter into a particle of dust and turn the great Dharma wheel. Do not arouse disdainful mind when you prepare a broth of wild grasses. Do not arouse joyful mind when you prepare a fine cream soup. Where there is no discrimination, how can there be distaste? Thus, do not be careless even when you work with poor materials, and sustain your efforts even when you have excellent materials. So continue to interact with what you have, and be okay with it. Never change your attitude according to the materials. If you do, it is like varying your truth when speaking with different people. Then you are not a practitioner of the way. If you encourage yourself with complete sincerity, you will want to exceed monks of old in wholeheartedness and ancient practitioners in thoroughness. The way for you to attain this is by trying to make a fine cream soup for 3 cents, in the same way that monks of old could make a broth of wild grasses for that little. It is difficult because the present and olden times differ as greatly as the distance between heaven and earth. No one now can be compared with those of ancient times. However, if you practice thoroughly, there will be a way to surpass them. I think that's true for many, many things. We cannot practice the same way as people in ancient times, and yet we can't just set up standards of our own. We have to find some way of being very, you know, intimate and familiar with those ancient ways in what we're doing now. If this is not yet clear to you, it is because your thoughts run around like a wild horse and your feelings jump about like a monkey in the forest. When the monkey and horse step back and reflect upon themselves, freedom from all discrimination is realized naturally. And he goes on to say, this is the way to turn things while being turned by things. While we cook ourselves, we're being cooked by our food while we're cooking it. Keep yourself harmonious and wholehearted in this way, and do not lose one eye or two eyes. Taking up a green vegetable, turn it into a 16-foot golden body, or a 16-foot golden Buddha. Take a 16-foot golden Buddha and turn it into a green vegetable leaf. This is a miraculous transformation, a work of Buddha that benefits sentient beings. Now that last piece, I also saw someone comment on it translated like this. Clarify and harmonize your life without losing the single eye which sees the context and the two eyes which recognize the details. So what I think he's talking about is the balance between recognizing the universal, where all things are the same, and being able to distinguish the particulars so that we don't, you know, maybe treat a mushroom the way we would treat a lentil. So that is part of what helps us to respond appropriately, and that is sort of what we're doing with working with food. We don't get all excited if we're making something super delicious, and we don't feel bad if we don't have, you know, the greatest ingredients. We just try to apply yourself with utmost sincerity and utmost effort. So the last piece I will read is, after I came back to Japan, I stayed for a few years at Kenin Monastery, where they had the Tenzo's position but did not understand its meaning. Although they used the name Tenzo, those who held the position did not have the proper spirit. They did not even know that this is a Buddha's practice, so how could they endeavor in the way? Indeed, it is a pity that they have not met a real master and are passing time in vain, violating the practice of the way. When I saw the monk who held the Tenzo's position in Kenin Monastery, he did not personally manage all of the preparations for the morning and noon meals. He used an ignorant, insensitive servant, and he had him do everything, both the important and the unimportant tasks. He never checked whether the servant's work was done correctly or not, as though it would be shameful or inappropriate to do, like watching a woman living next door. He stayed in his own room where he would lie down, chat, read sutras, or chant. So this Tenzo, I guess, would kind of do that, where it's like, okay, work's getting taken care of, I can go just, you know, flake out. For days and months, he did not come close to a pan, buy cooking equipment, or think about menus. How could he have known that these are Buddha activities? Furthermore, he would not even have dreamed of 9 bows before sending the meals out. When it comes time to train a young monk, he still will not know anything. How regrettable it is that he is a man without way-seeking mind and that he has not met someone who has the virtue of the way. It is just like returning empty-handed after entering a treasure mountain or coming back unadorned after reaching the ocean of jewels. Even if you have not aroused the thought of enlightenment, if you have seen a person manifesting original self, you can still practice and attain the way. I think that's great. Even if you have not aroused the thought of enlightenment, if you have seen a person manifesting original self, you still can practice and attain the way. Or if you have not seen a person manifesting original self, but have deeply aroused the aspiration for enlightenment, you can be one with the way. If you lack both of these, how can you receive even the slightest benefit? When you see those who hold positions as officers and staff in the monasteries of Great Song China, although they serve for a 1-year term, each of them abides by 3 guidelines, practicing these in every moment, following them at every opportunity. First one is benefit others. This simultaneously benefits yourself. 2, contribute to the growth and elevation of the monastery. And 3, emulate masters of old, following and respecting their excellent examples. You should understand that there are foolish people who do not take care of themselves because they do not take care of others. And I guess they also do not take care of others because they do not take care of themselves. And there are wise people who care for others just as they care for themselves. A teacher of old said, 2/3 of your life has passed, not polishing even a spot of your source of sacredness. You devour your life. Your days are busy with this and that. If you don't turn around at my shout, what can I do? You should know that if you have not met a true master, you will be swept away by human desire. What a pity. It is like the foolish son of the wealthy man who carries a treasure from his father's house and discards it like dung. You should not waste your time as that man did. So I like that he has these 3 guidelines for one's attitude as Tenzo, or as practitioners of Zen, you know, benefiting others, contributing to the growth and elevation of the community, and then emulating masters of old, finding a way to, you know, bring way-seeking mind into your life right now. So I guess in closing, I think that, you know, I used to think Tenzo was a position that I could never possibly hold because I didn't really cook. I spent most of my adult life not really cooking so much. And I used to joke that if I ever became Tenzo, we would all just be eating lean cuisines. And so we'd have to pull the microwave down from on top of the fridge. But it turns out that you can just get cookbooks and follow recipes. You don't have to have a particular talent, because actually cooking is probably the easy part of this job. The real work for the Tenzo is no different than the real work for anybody in any other position or anyone who is in the Zendo practicing, because it's really, you know, finding a way to maintain way-seeking mind and to see how each of the things that we're doing in the moment is really an opportunity to wake up, really an opportunity to, you know, extend yourself beyond, you know, my own sort of like, I want this and I don't want that. You know, and it can really only happen by fully, you know, giving yourself to the task at hand. So I think that's all I want to say. if anybody has questions or comments about cooking or way-seeking mind or, you know, anything else or any other way that that's manifesting in your life, please feel free. Laurel.
That was so appropriate right before Thanksgiving.
Oh, Thanksgiving! I didn't even think of Thanksgiving! You're all going to be Tenzos!
I would say two things. One is that it might not be obvious to people who don't come here a lot, but that the success of these experiences here, a sitting like this, is that many people are doing jobs. Someone is ringing the bell, and someone is greeting, and so forth. And it's a wonderful way to practice. And if in your continuing experience with meditation you have any interest in learning about that, please just let one of us know here, and we'd be very happy to talk to you about how you could incorporate that into your practice with us here at this. And the second thing I would say is, so next Sunday, it's my turn to do the talk, and I'm going to talk about the attitude of the eater at a meal.
Sort
of a bookend.
Okay.
So Taigen always refers to Thanksgiving as his favorite Buddhist holiday, because it is about gratitude and generosity, so it'll sort of be continued. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and actually, we will have a 5-day sesshin the week after that. So if there's anybody who would like to experience even just a day or a half day of a sesshin, we'll talk afterwards, and I'll make a formal announcement about it later. But thank you.
Aishan, I enjoyed that very much. And it made me think about a couple of experiences where, you know, it's like things that have encouraged me to shift from, you know, thinking about meals as like, okay, what do I feel like? What would be enjoyable? To thinking about it in a way that kind of fits into my life more.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was I used to do Tai Chi classes, and sometimes we'd be there all day on Saturdays. And our teacher's wife was a really good cook and would make this mung bean soup, and we would have it at break. And it's kind of like you were hungry, you needed some energy. A small amount of that was all you needed to kind of feel ready to go again. And so it was something that was, eating just enough, not too much. Wasn't a super exciting meal, but it was just right. And my other was at Green Gulch when I was working in the garden. And, you know, it's like you're hungry at meals. And you're eating it, and you kind of feel energized. You're not eating too much. I noticed, too, there weren't desserts every day. And it was like you became very excited when there were cookies on Saturday. But it also puts you in a different relationship to food. You know, not yeah. someone, you know, like sometimes at the end of the day you're tired, and it's like, oh, what do I feel like eating? It's very different. It's more a kind of what kind of keeps your body going and kind of fits in with the need for energy and the rest of your day.
Yeah. Thank you for the observation. Yeah, I've found it to be such a relief to be in situations where you don't have to make these choices, or you don't have to think about, excuse me for a sec. What do I feel like or not feel like? It helps you kind of, it helps me kind of relax a little bit, a little bit more, and let myself be supported by what is there, rather than always this sort of self-conscious, self-directed sort of like, how can I get, you know, what do I need to do? But thanks. Yeah, Libby.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a really fun talk for me. And part of what was bringing up for me was, I think, was sort of reconnecting with that sense of the power of these teachings and of the structures that have been created. You know, that, and because what I kept having memories of, these 10-day meditation retreats that I've done in the past that were really structured, and where, like when you were saying the thing about, oh, you just get home and you just want to throw your stuff on, you know, and I remember when there would be a break in the middle of the day, you know, it would be a very sort of structured day, and you're like disciplining yourself and sitting, and then there's a break, and you're like, oh, how do I relate to this freedom? And you're still practicing, you're still very aware, you know, that's the instructions to keep practicing. And so even if you know, I'd be like really tired, so I woke up at, you know, 4 a.m, and so I wanted to kind of rest, but I couldn't quite sleep. But it was like, it's okay, like instead of sort of craving, like, oh, I just want to feel good right now, it was like, well, let me just observe whatever it feels like to lie on this bed and allow my body to just, you know, relax a little bit, but I can also notice the tension, and I can also notice whatever. It was like just sort of hanging in there with all the ups and downs and ins and outs of your experience. And there's a way that, like, now that there's this attempt to use this idea of mindfulness and kind of separate it out of Buddhist practice, and that's very wonderful and in its own way, but there's something that it's very hard to have true, like to bring that awareness and practice really to the fullness of your life without these structures. That there's a way that these structures are hard, and they're finicky and funny and weird, and, you know, the robes and the bowing and the everything, you know, and yet they give us this opportunity to do this practice in a full way that's really extraordinary. It's like, So thank you.
Yeah, it is really with it, when we take on a discipline of whatever it is in life, that you get the opportunity to see all the ways in which you react to things, just by being encouraged to do that. Thanks. Anybody? Joan?
I agree with Laurel. This is perfect timing. but I'm thinking about how I can apply this in preparing for Thanksgiving. Because it's easy to go, okay, have I done this? Have I done that? I better do this first, and so on. But to bring that kind of attention and mindfulness to each step of preparation. Mm-hmm. So it's very timely. Thank you.
You know, I was going to include one other passage from this, and if you have this at home in any anthology, it's very short. It's about 16 pages. I would encourage you to go ahead and read it. The part that I didn't include is the part that I think maybe speaks most to what you both are saying, where it talks about the three different kinds of mind that one should bring to the task of Tenzo. One is joyful mind, where we're just joyful to be able to, you know, bring joy to other people. Even I think Dogen recognized that, you know, food makes us happy, you know. It's not like, what I mean by that is it's not some new idea. Comfort food didn't originate in, you know, with your grandmother. It's something that has always brought joy to people. And so we have joyful mind, we have kind mind or parental mind, which is wanting to take care of people, wanting to, you know, care for others the way that we would care for children and make sure that they have well-being. And then great mind, where the great mind would be the third one, where we don't make so much of a distinction between all the things. We just try to relate to them as well as possible. You know, whether we like, you know, making mashed potatoes, we would have preferred to make, you know, rutabaga or something, but our family wanted mashed potatoes, or we had some, you know, Martha Stewart recipe that we wanted to do, but nobody likes that, so we had to do, you know, plain old stuffing out of a bag. We just relate to whatever, whatever it is that's coming up. So, I appreciate that you both are bringing in the aspect of gratitude that we can have as eater or as cook or as being a part of this. Anybody have any questions about anything else? Oh, Deborah.
Appreciated your comments about wanting to just get through some activities like washing the dishes.
Yeah.
When I realized so much of life is mundane activities, doing maintenance and preparation and that kind of thing, and if there isn't any separation between that and the rest of my life, it opens up a huge space for mindfulness and for presence, rather than those being narrow moments that are somehow more valuable to me.
Yeah.
It's all valuable. For many different reasons.
So much of life is repetitive, and so much of it is mundane. I remember I was born in the 60s, and my mom was, I think in the beginning of my childhood, she was really happy about it, and you know, she had her three kids, and she was like very psyched about being a mom. And then the 70s came along, where she started getting all these messages about you should want more, and this is not as worthy as, you know, going out and doing, you know, what men do, and that, you know, being home and cooking and cleaning was, and doing all these repetitive things was somehow boring or somehow menial or somehow less. And I think that this is a nice way to speak to that too, that we all have just, you know, the business of maintaining and sustaining our lives is, it's painstaking, and it's really something to be celebrated that anyone would go through the trouble of caring for others, and that is a, you know, it's an activity that expresses our innate dignity rather than being something to, you know, kind of push aside or pretend we don't have to do or hire, you know, not that this is whatever, you know, shunting it off on somebody else. So thanks.